Hello and welcome to Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood. I was planning to do a rerun for this week's show to give myself a little holiday break, but I wasn't planning this one. A memorial to Leo Penitch, the Canadian political scientist who died on December 19th at the age of 75. Last month he was diagnosed with multiple myeloma, a blood cancer, but the prognosis looked good for 10 years of relatively normal life. But he caught COVID while in the hospital, and the pneumonia it induced killed him. This has been a truly awful year. Leo was on this show many times, both alone and with his longtime friend and collaborator, Sam Gindin. Leo was a marvelous human in every dimension, a wonderful thinker, comrade, and friend. I met him just over 20 years ago when he was living in New York for the year, doing research that would eventually figure in the book he and Sam published in 2012, The Making of Global Capitalism. We would see each other several times a year, either in Toronto, where he lived, or in New York, on his frequent visits. Unlike many high-end intellectuals, he was always unfailingly warm and generous. My now teenage son, who mocks our dinner table conversations as capitalism, bourgeoisie, blah, 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 always liked Leo, and vice versa. They could talk about baseball and hockey in between our yammering about the law of value. That says something about the kind of human he was. Leo was born to a working-class family in 1945 in Winnipeg. He got his bachelor's degree from the University of Manitoba, and then did graduate work at the London School of Economics, where he studied with Ralph Miliband. Leo took up Miliband's interest in the political side of capitalism, the role of the state in shaping the system, and the role of political parties in shaping both the ruling class and the system's supposed gravedigger, the working class. He also wrote extensively about the U.S.-dominated international order. Leo always resisted narratives of U.S. decline, arguing that it was still the center of an imperial system, and not one like the old European empires which involved the subjugation of colonial populations, but one which incorporated other nations into a hierarchical system that still allowed them a considerable degree of autonomy and prosperity, especially the second-tier powers of Western Europe, as well as Japan and Canada. Latin America, however, was often not so lucky. Leo spent most of his professional life at York University in Toronto, where he taught from 1984 until his retirement in 2016. He created a splendid, largely Marxist, political science department there. A visit to York was always stimulating and fun as well. Leo and his colleagues were not ones to don the hair shirt. As a memorial to Leo, I'm running excerpts of two interviews. The first is from an interview recorded in 2012 with Leo and Sam in the publication by Verso of The Making of Global Capitalism, The Political Economy of the American Empire. It's hard to think about Leo without also thinking about Sam, his lifelong friend and collaborator. Sam spent many years as an economist with the Canadian Auto Workers, which he eventually left for a stint teaching at York. These are just excerpts from a long interview, so there may be some discontinuities and missed antecedents, though I hope they're not too serious. Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin.
When did the American elite really start conceiving of its global ambitions?
Well, you could say it started conceiving of them with Teddy Roosevelt and even Taft in the first decade of the 20th century in some ways. Roosevelt, in his State of the Union address in 1901, talked about a civilizing mission that was somewhat different than the white man's burden of the British Empire. It was bringing the rule of law to benighted third world states who weren't able to protect
them. That kind of thing was not absent from British discourse.
No, it wasn't. But those ambitions were there. Now, at that time, it was about displacing or at least getting into the spheres of the interest of the other empires. But, you know, it was articulated and repeated again by Coolidge right after World War I, not just by Wilson, articulated in terms of the American responsibility to maintain what they called civilization, rules of law, etc. And you started seeing the first American direct investment around that time. Nothing as big as it later became, but it was with that I think you started seeing it.
But the American state at that point was still a rather paltry thing.
Right. It had much less capacity than it was to develop in the 1930s with the New Deal and then during the Second World War. I think, there's a very famous economic historian, Charles Kinderberger, who says that between the two world wars, the British had lost the capacity to run the world, and the Americans hadn't yet acquired the will to. But it wasn't just a matter of will, it's what you say. They didn't have the institutional capacity to do it.
We're accustomed to thinking that the New Deal was mostly a domestic affair, but in fact, the build-up of the state had international implications, right?
Yeah, it had international implications. Roosevelt's decision to, at this very famous Economic Conference in 1933 to break with the orthodoxy of the central bankers in the interwar period and to, you know, effectively take the United States off gold, to reject their austerity programs of the kind that we see today in this crisis, was in a sense more of a break from interwar internationalism than Hoover had ever done as Secretary of Commerce before he was president. But it coincided with a certain responsibility taken on from 34 on to try to, with the French and the British especially, to manage international currencies despite the beggar my neighbor policies of the interwar period. And by the end of the 30s, certainly the American elite, epitomized by people like Acheson, were articulating a responsibility by 1939, even before the United States entered the war, to ensure that the world after the war would be open to free enterprise. The American way of living would not be possible or safe if Europe in particular did not rejected a free enterprise society.
And I think a part of that that was so important in the mid-30s was the recognition that to have that look outward required you to actually fix things at home. That fixing things at home was crucial to playing that, to moving out.
What aspects of fixing things at home are you talking about?
The Depression. That if you were going to simply accept the gold standard, it would be a barrier to actually fixing things at home. So fixing things at home meant getting the economy moving, especially responding to the fact that you actually had people in motion who were challenging capitalism itself.
During the 30s and World War II, the American elite was quite consciously plotting the not entirely friendly takeover of the British Empire, wasn't it?
If it could be friendly, that would have been fine, but they were quite prepared to play very hardball with the British for giving them what was known as Lend-Lease, that is, the wherewithal to fight World War II. I don't think it was as narrow as wanting to take over the empire. It was an expectation that in order to get back to 19th century free trade, it would have to be the United States that led it. I think there was also a certain degree of disdain for the colonialism of the British. The Americans defined themselves in terms of their break, their revolutionary break from being a colony. And although during the era of Roosevelt, Teddy that is, they had acquired a certain number of colonies or effective colonies, that didn't turn out to be the pattern for the way the American empire expanded. So, you know, the United States was very much in favor of the decolonization of the European empires, and very much so, including the British.
Which I think what Leo's saying, what's so important about it is that it isn't just a matter of here's another empire that becomes the biggest kid on the block and simply replaces Britain. We're really talking about a different kind of an empire now that sees itself as in its own interest, in the interest of its own capital, trying to create a global capitalism that is open to all global capital.
So coming out of World War II, then, the experience of the 20s and 30s was very fresh in people's minds, and they did not want to repeat those mistakes, right?
Right.
So what was the plan to do it a new way?
Well, I mean, I think Sam should talk about the really important part of this, which I think most people miss, which is what was done at home. Most people who discuss this discuss Bretton Woods, and most people see that in terms of giving independent nation states a certain room for maneuver in the international monetary system, permission, if you like, on the part of people who joined the IMF and the World Bank to have capital controls for a period, although the implication of, and certainly the intention of the Americans, was that that would only be for a period. And eventually they'd get to the point of where the Americans were after 1945, which is removing all capital controls. And that was important. I mean, I think it did provide a framework which gave a certain breathing room for the rebuilding of European capitalist states. The bankers on Wall Street were not very cooperative and were very happy to receive as much capital as could escape Europe after 1945 rather than allow it to remain there. Some historians have actually argued that all of the Marshall Plan funds really just was compensating for the escape of capital from Europe. I think that's probably an exaggeration. But, you know, Wall Street would have had the United States not undertaken Marshall Fund activities and limited the bankers in this way. Wall Street would have been quite happy to have, for instance, Britain, they insisted that Britain make sterling convertible right after the war. And it was a disaster. And there was a massive outflow of capital, and the British had to then pull back from the convertibility of sterling in 1946. So, you know, there was a sense in which the American state was not following what Wall Street wanted. In other ways, they compensated with they compromised with Wall Street in all kinds of ways. But the most significant thing of what they did was they built the material base for empire at home.
That's the voice of Leo Panitch, who is a co-author, along with Sam Ginnan, of The Making of Global Capitalism, just out from Verso. All right, Sam, what about that home front?
What was critical on the home front was dealing with labor, integrating labor, and taking advantage of that period of growth.
Also, it wasn't entirely pacified.
No, it wasn't entirely pacified. Labor had come out quite militant. You had a strong labor movement, and you had strong capital at the time. Dealing with labor and both defeating it and integrating it through the welfare state was very important also as a model for Europe, to move Europe away from just seeing capital-labor relations in terms of distribution, zero-sum games, but also seeing a certain kind of productivism. If you looked at the American model and American mass production, mass consumption, that this was a model. Now, the trouble with this was that it creates its own contradictions. As you get into the late 60s, you've got the contradiction with labor, that if the American state is going to take this responsibility for the empire, it has to deal with, on the one hand, protecting profits at home, because labor was strong enough to frustrate the continued growth of profits as the advantages that they had coming out of the war began to wear off. But also crucial was containing inflation so you can maintain confidence in the dollar was absolutely fundamental. So coping with labor after the 60s was fundamental to profits at home and to inflation and the international role of the dollar. So it's crucial to what was happening internationally.
Now, this is an important point because the American elite at that point was acting in what it considered the broadest interest of the system as a whole. They were not acting out of pure, narrowly defined short-term self-interest, right? I mean, this is, you know, it's not the pure selfishness, you know, the pure short-term selfishness a lot of people attribute to them. They're really thinking about things.
You could say selfishness, but they certainly were thinking long-term, and they understood that the greatest danger was that if any of Europe were to leave capitalism, that the spread of capitalism and the spread of capitalist relations and the development of Europe was absolutely fundamental to American long-term interests. So it wasn't isolated. You know, I didn't want to get isolated again and go back to the 30s where you had countries, you know, moving towards autarky or worse.
And the U.S. government is also encouraging U.S. corporations to invest abroad.
Yes, although there wasn't much of that going on in Europe, and even less in Japan, since the Japanese were much less keen on it than the Europeans were, until the late 1950s, and then the explosion in the 1960s. And for American corporations to be interested in investing in Europe, you first had to get the development of a high-wage proletariat again, a working class capable of consuming in Europe, for there to be an enormous expansion. You know, of course, General Motors and Ford had been in Europe since the 1920s, and they were, in a sense, the only European corporations in the sense that they actually spanned borders in Europe. It was American MNCs, which were the first pan-European corporations. But the really vast increase of foreign direct investment into Europe, there was a tremendous shift from, you know, American direct investment being concentrated in Canada and Latin America. By 1965, Europe was now the place where American investment was massively located.
And the Marshall Plan was crucial to this. You're raising the question of the commitment of the American state and American capital to reviving Europe. I mean, without a Marshall Plan, you know, if you're trying to imagine Europe finding the resources for investment, it would have meant squeezing the working class more and risking the political repercussions of that. So the Marshall Plan was very important for that. And Europe didn't have the capacity to simply start exporting to the United States, even if the United States let them in, unless you were simultaneously helping them to develop. So they were actually transferring technology to Europe throughout this time, even without MNCs, just directly through exchanges.
Productivity councils, etc.
The U.S. is aware that it was creating what would become competition over the long term.
Very explicitly. very explicitly. The State Department and the Treasury were talking this way during the war. It was made public in this very famous, or I don't know how famous it was later, but at the time it was famous, pamphlet in Fortune, Time, and Life magazine, which said, after the war, there's going to have to be a new American empire, different from the old ones. We will not have colonial civil servants. We're not afraid of having industrial competitors to ourselves. That's what capitalism is all about. The point is to get free enterprise going in every major European country. And
they more or less meant this.
And they really meant it, I think. Now, they is what has to be careful here, because what the United States is happening to the United States, more than the United States is doing, is it's acquiring the burden of representing the world's capital, of not just representing the American capitalist class, but representing capitalists everywhere. And the move into Europe is very much empire by invitation on the part of their ruling classes. Not least because in a good many European countries there's a very radical working class, often communist-led, but in any case, whether it's communist-led or not, often very radical. And they're quite afraid of that working class, the European bourgeoisie, and look to the United States as their protector. And I don't mean a protector in the sense of the Soviet invasion. The key to the Marshall Plan is not the threat of the Soviets crossing borders. The key to it is, will the Greek communists come to power in Greece? Will the French communists stay in government? Will the Italians, because they were in coalition governments after the war, with the right to strike enshrined in those constitutions? This is very much an alliance between the European ruling classes and increasingly European social democrats who are looking to a mixed economy and the American ruling class.
Again, the voice of Leo Panitch, co-author with Sam Ginden of The Making of Global Capitalism, just out from Verso. This is certainly a new concept of empire, with the United States at the pinnacle, sort of junior partners, Europe, increasingly Japan, your country, Canada.
Is the model.
The model vassal, who is actually pretty well off. But now, what about the rest of the world, the former colonies? What was happening with them?
The book's called The Making of Global Capitalism because it is this long process of trying to make a truly global capitalism. But it's much more difficult in the third world. The nature of this empire is that it tries to operate through economic institutions, through the social relations and legal structures of markets and the free flow of capital and free trade. In the third world, this is much more difficult. And it's much more difficult in part because as they're breaking out of colonialism, there's also nationalist movements in there. Until the later 70s, you've got a lot of expropriations going on. So part of the role of the American state is to manage this in a way that tries to keep them within capitalism, that actually keeps resources in particular safe, not just for themselves, not just oil for themselves, but safe for capital, for this global capitalism that they're building. And you begin to see through the later 70s into the 80s and 90s, the beginnings of integrating the third world itself. Much more difficult, much more uneven, full of contradictions. But, you know, you can say at this point in time, there's very few countries anywhere who are speaking about leaving global capitalism.
The big difference is that whereas Europe wanted to, including most European workers by the 1950s, wanted to be like America, in much of the third world by the late 1950s, you had The Ugly American, that famous book and film. Even though the United States fostered decolonization, it was also seen as limiting nationalist ambitions. It wasn't uniformly so. We've uncovered some evidence that the State Department was actually promoting import substitution industrialization and looked kindly for a certain period on Raul Prebisch, who was the great Latin American economist who articulated this. But by the 60s, with a switch, of Kennedy's switch, the United States giving aid to third world countries to giving them loans, and in order to pay back those loans, they have to export. That was the dynamic that began to push these countries towards what eventually became the free trade models of the 80s and 90s.
We're listening to excerpts from a long interview with Leo Panitch and Sam Ginden about their book, The Making of Global Capitalism. I cut a lot of material here about the 1960s and 70s, and we're picking up with the neoliberal restructuring that began as the 70s were turning into the 80s.
Yeah, and it's, I think, important to underscore that it was really quite successful from their point of view. I mean, there, you sometimes hear people talk about the long crisis that began in 73 or whatever, but that was, you know, 25 or 30 years of very successful restructuring that made a lot of people very rich and powerful.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. You can't measure the decline of the empire in terms of what it is doing to inequality or to working people. It's a question of what is it doing for capital.
And capital has been mostly very happy. But now we're really running low on time, so let's talk about the crisis. That all started coming undone 2006, 2007, and then really blew apart in 2008. Still not looking so good now. So what's your analysis of where they are now? Are they up to another restructuring of that sort? Do they know what they're doing?
That's the $64 question. To some extent, the way they solved the crisis laid the basis for the current crisis. They had 25 years, as long as the post-war golden age, of a good run with very high productivity growth, et cetera. And they kept it going through credit.
Yeah, if you're squeezing wages and benefits, you got to keep a mass consumption system going.
Exactly.
Somehow, right?
And it wasn't only credit cards, it was mortgages, et cetera. And the working class was buying into it in the sense that apart from their home being the only asset they had, they were, you know, looking at what their pensions were returning on the stock market. You know, that eventually blew into the credit bubble the mortgage security market created. Very much fomented, facilitated, first under Clinton, but especially under Bush, through low interest rates, through this enormous flow of capital into the United States, which meant there was all this money sloshing around to go into the credit markets, and through banks around the world being more than happy to buy, anxious to buy, American mortgage securities because they thought they were backed by the American state. And they yielded a higher rate of return than the Treasury bills did. So the whole world was involved in this credit bubble. And you got a crisis that was created this time not by the strength of labor, wage push inflation, but rather in some ways by the weakness of labor, by the role of credit in the system, mass credit in the system. And because it was a housing bubble, as Sam's often pointed out, it had immediate knock-on effects.
Well, Sam, as you like to point out, that, you know, the incorporation of the working class into the financial system is a very important development over the last couple of decades, right?
Yeah, it's very important with contradictions. I mean, it's very important because as they lose their collective strength, they've tried to survive individually. And that in surviving individually has meant a range of things, from working longer hours, but including looking to financial markets to help them, the pensions and the stock market, even housing as an asset, but credit more generally.
And the working class now has a real material interest in financial stability.
Yes, and you know, one of the things that you can say about this crisis is that the American state did put a lid on the, you know, the generation of this crisis into a Great Depression. They contained the crisis, and I think that that's a very important part of it. They haven't been able to stimulate the economy. That's going to affect finance as well. And what Lee and I have been emphasizing is there's a number of contradictions here that are really important to bring out. One is that capitalism needs finance. It isn't just speculative. So the problem you have is that finance is necessary for the globalization of capital. They need it for risk, et cetera, derivatives, et cetera. But it's very volatile. So how do you balance this volatility versus the fact that you need it? You don't want to contain the volatility to the extent that you limit finance's role within capital.
And traders love volatility. They'd be very frustrated with that.
There's also this question that you know, we've been emphasizing, that you're still trying to keep the confidence of finance. Finance is still so fundamental to the system that you're trying to keep their confidence, and that trying to maintain the confidence of finance leads you to austerity, as it did during the Depression as well, because finance is concerned about higher wages. It's concerned about whether it's going to lose the value of its assets to inflation, or in the cases of Europe and other countries, whether it's actually going to see default. And the other problem that I think has been very important in the work Leo's always done around the state is that states are still sovereign. The United States can't just proclaim what happened. So it can look at Europe with some frustration, but it still has to depend on Europe working this out. So the system is very fragile.
They're not colonies.
All kinds of contradictions.
They're not colonies, and the Americans have had this trouble with the German central bankers since the 1970s.
There's Honduras and there's Germany, right?
Yes. There's Honduras and there's Germany, and right. Germany matters. And they've had to pull the German central bankers kicking and screaming to take responsibility for managing global capitalism since the banking crises of the 1970s. They've been very reluctant to do it. The American state in that sense has been far more interventionist, far more ready to take responsibility for managing the global system. The Germans have been much more particularist and narrow-minded. This isn't a new thing. Now, they put pressure on them in the last year, and you've seen a response. Nevertheless, as Sam says, this is not a colony, and it does involve a great deal of negotiation. In the end, we interviewed German central bankers, and they said to us, "We propose, the Americans dispose," which actually comes from the biographer of Keynes. Keynes allegedly said that of the Americans during World War II as well.
There's one thing that I think that you started with, Doug, that's important here, and that is that in the 30s, part of the reason that there was a solution that ended up saving capitalism was that the working class was actually strong enough to force certain things. And at this point in time, a stronger working class that was actually able to enforce some stimulus in the economy is probably what capitalism needs.
Those are excerpts from an interview recorded in 2012 of Leo Panitch and Sam Ginnin about their book, The Making of Global Capitalism, from Verso. My name is Doug Henwood, and the program is Behind the News. Back after a musical break. Some of the first movement of Beethoven's String Quartet No. 14, which Wagner called the most melancholy passage in all of music. I'll concede that his musical universe may be limited, but it is a sublime passage, appropriate to mourn the death of Leo Panitch. And now on to another interview with Leo, this from 2018 about Trump and the global order. Now that Trump is leaving, this is a good time to think about how he fits into history, which surprisingly, this two-year-old interview does a very good job of.
It looks like Trump is, I wouldn't say systematically, because that's not the right word to use about anything he does, but it does look like Trump is destroying one by one the pillars of the American empire as established at the end of World War II. You know, he's going after NATO, he's going after the whole principle of multilateralism, he seems to be just acting as if the U.S. is the big guy around, he's going to push everybody around, tell him what to do. His trade policy is mystifying. Is this the suicide of the American empire led by Donald Trump?
To some extent, I guess, although, you know, what he thinks he's doing is bargaining. He is trying to get a better deal in this hyper-nationalist conception he has of the American interest. There's always been a element of the American ruling class, and maybe even a stronger element of the Babbitts in the American capitalist class, you know, the Midwest medium-sized businessmen, and even to some extent the Texas oilmen, who never quite got the predominant strategy, which was shared by post-war Republicans and New Deal Democrats, on incorporating other states into the American empire. They just never got it. So, you know, the WTO wasn't created until 1996 because Senator Taft and the Republicans made it impossible for Harry Truman to get it through in the late 1940s. There's been a consistent element of the ruling class, you know, even in the 80s with financialization, when it was obvious the extent to which Wall Street's predominance in the world, its inventiveness, the creation of all these new financial products, was pulling so much capital into the United States that was more than compensating for any trade deficit. Well, even then, you already saw the kind of mentality represented by Wilbur Ross or Navarro. In fact, it was the Peterson Institute that was articulating it in the early 80s, that America's getting a raw deal. Now, you know, I think in an objective way, this is ludicrous. In order to draw independent states into the American Empire, especially ones that had formerly been foes, like Japan and Germany, the Americans did make it easy for them to adopt this semi-sovereign status in the American Empire. They gave them a very good deal on exchange rates until the 1980s. You could argue the Germans had a good deal even with the euro. And then under Reagan, they changed that with the Japanese. And it's often been the case that they've let other countries have restrictions on the inflow of capital, especially East Asia, which is one of the reasons the NICs, as they're called, did so well, which was that there were limits, strict limits, that the Americans allowed them to have in terms of the penetration by American capital. And that meant they built up an autonomous manufacturing industry. There's a basis on which to say, if you are a Babbitt, well, the Americans have gotten a raw deal. We've offered these guys too much. Now, there's another interpretation, which is that these are such troglodytes that it isn't even a matter of negotiating a better deal for the empire. It's actually a matter of wanting to blow it up and recreate a pre-World War I inter-imperial rivalry world.
I saw comments of Yanis Varoufakis recently where he says that Trump is trying to replace the multilateral American system with a hub-and-spoke system in which the U.S. has bilateral relations with every country in the world, with the U.S. as the center. Do you think there's anything to that?
Any realistic view of the world does already involve a hub-and-spoke relationship. The European Union's relationship with the United States partly takes place through Brussels, and the Americans certainly encourage, from the late 40s on, the creation of the common market and eventually the European Union. But that didn't mean that they didn't have individual relationships with each of the states, especially insofar as one's talking about their relationship to NATO. The military strategic security relationship goes through each of the European states. So there's always been a hub-and-spoke relationship complemented by the multilateral. And the multilateral one, the American MNCs wanted, because they wanted completely open capital markets and trade relationships inside Europe. When they invested, say, in Spain, Ford wanted to be able to sell right across Europe from that the plant in Spain. That didn't replace a hub-and-spoke one. Now, could it be, and I think it could be, that people like Navarro and Ross and even Trump, insofar as he has a clear view on these things, think that this hyper-nationalist American national interest will be better served by doing away with the EU. It's possible. I mean, just like there are many Marxists, Doug, who have never gotten over seeing the world in terms of the old theory of imperialism, so there are many on the right who see the world in a similar way and, you know, therefore don't understand the extent to which the creation of this global capitalist system under the aegis of an informal American empire has actually redounded to the great benefit of the United States. And you can see the reaction, the resistance, coming from so much of the establishment, and, of course, from the multinational corporations and the Wall Street banks to this. Now, that's not to say they can stop this. They are sitting there with bated breath, just as Germany and China are, wondering how far these idiots will take this.
Well, now let's talk about a bit about China. China looks like the up-and-comer in a lot of ways, developing its own substantial technological manufacturing capacity, no longer just the, you know, the workshop of the world working at low wages, with very ambitious imperial schemes like the Belt and Road scheme to building infrastructure around much of the world, while the U.S. is looking inward and is bitter and backward-looking. Is China about to surpass the U.S. in some sense? Not about to, but on the path to surpass the U.S. in some sense?
Not in our lifetime, and I don't think even in the case of your son Ivan, as much younger as my children. I was about to say there are elements of the American state which obviously have an interest in fomenting inter-imperial rivalry. To some extent, the Defense Department, ironically, the security establishment that Trump is so at odds with. Part of the tension with China relates to the interest that those elements of the state have in what E.P. Thompson, back in the early 80s, at the time of the Cruise Missile Crisis, called the logic of exterminism, between those elements of the Soviet bureaucracy and those elements of the American bureaucracy. And to some extent, that goes on with China as well. It builds up their bureaucratic apparatuses that have this kind of rivalry going on, even though they can be a lot more cautious about actually wanting to go to war. And I think they are. They do want to keep up the tension. And so do the multinational corporations, of course, who create the toys that they play with, the lethal toys that they play with. But insofar as you're talking about the economic dimension, the fact is that while it was always going to be much more difficult to integrate China or Russia, for that matter, into the informal American empire, not least because they were never occupied by the American army, as Japan was, but also because, of course, the cultural differences are so immense as compared with the empire's relationship with, say, Western Europe. But the fact is, at the moment, that China's development, and it has been absolutely remarkable, and it's become a major capitalist industrial state, as you say, at the moment, it's very much locked into the American consumer empire, the Western consumer empire, but especially the American. It does not have what we on the left used to call a Fordist strategy yet in place, whereby its industrial development, its accumulation, is reinforced by selling to its own middle class and working class. It requires access to foreign markets, and especially the American market. Secondly, the squeeze that the Americans are putting on them in terms of Trump is putting on them, in terms of technology transfer, is a very real thing. And the fact is that this is the late developer in history. China is the late developer in history, you know, which has had the most foreign direct investment as part of its development, far more than Germany did in the late 19th century. Japan had hardly any, although they came and borrowed loads of technology. There's massive foreign direct investment, and a great deal of it is American, and that's really important in terms of their development. And, in fact, the response of Xi and the Chinese state generally to Trump's bluster has been to promise multinational corporations and foreign banks that they will go much further in terms of opening up, not least opening up their financial market. Now, that gets very dangerous for the Chinese communist elite, capitalist communist elite. That's what they are in this strange, dialectical, bizarre world. That is very dangerous for them because they don't have control over capital flows and the allocation of capital. Things could get very dicey in terms of reproducing their rule inside China.
Well, how do you see the reaction of the second tier powers, you know, Japan, Canada, EU, to this, you know, Trump's big swinging dick act?
They hate it. They absolutely hate it. That said, there's only so much they can do about it. You know, and to some extent, the Canadians have stood up more than the Japanese have. Astonishing, given that we in Canada are by far the most integrated into the American empire. And what happened to Europe in the 1960s was called by a certain very astute European commentators Canadianization, precisely because the American capitalist class is implanted inside Canada as a domestic class. You know, when General Motors workers make demands, we're working in Windsor, make demands on the Canadian state, they make it as the workers of a, you could say, foreign corporation. But, you know, that portion of American capital is implanted as a class force inside Canada, as it is now in Europe as well, less so in Japan, because the Japanese have never been very open, and the Americans have allowed this. What Trump realized in his crude way is that there's a degree of dependence that allows him to be the type of shyster high bargainer that he's trained to be. And then he gets advice from the Navarros and Rosses of this world, which is cast in this hyper-nationalist terms, which one can argue, I think, very rationally, is not in the interest of a stable reproduction of the empire. And heaven knows what the result of this is going to be. I mean, I'm not one of those who thinks that there's a rational capitalist common interest that the capitalist class knows, that it then rings up the President of the United States and tells him what to do in their interest. States have a lot of autonomy, as I know you do, Doug. And while they are constrained by the structural relations that capitalism imposes. They aren't entirely controlled in it by any means. And I think, you know, just like China and Russia, these capitalists are holding their breath.
I'm speaking with the political scientist Leo Panitch. There's an interesting split going on now with the Koch brothers and the right, or in August, which was called the Koch Network now that David is failing. They're really turning against Trump in a very public way, and Trump was on Twitter making fun of them. This portion, very well-organized, very rich portion of the American capitalist class seems to be at war with Trump, but the rest of the capitalist class, you're not seeing like Tim Cook and Apple and people like that really fighting in any kind of, at least very public way, this nationalist agenda, which would seem to be against their corporate material interests. How do you read the state of the American ruling class at this point?
It does show you how narrow-minded capitalists are. Look how long it took for the auto company to come out publicly against Trump. You know, right in their own backyard in relation to Canada and Mexico, given their how much their strategy of shifting production costs to cheap labor in Mexico has been the basis for their revival in the last two decades. It's really astonishing, and it shows you how frightened capitalists are of the state. Their recognition, the degree of autonomy that states had, how much it can impinge on them, how much capital is dependent on what states do to protect their property, reproduce the conditions of their accumulation, etc. They have always understood this. And what's now very interesting, I think they're being quiet because they recognize this and they don't want to antagonize it.
They're afraid of Trump's tweeting against them. And it's remarkable that the president's tweets can have such effect on these people who seem to be incredibly powerful.
Yes, and we'll look at the corruption in Germany and Hitler. I mean, this is why we need to be so frightened, that when it comes to defending their private property, their existence, they will in the end be prepared to support a fascist. That's not to say that they aren't expressing in some fashion, quietly, through their trade associations, etc., their discomforts. They are. On the other hand, I think both Silicon Valley and Wall Street, if Trump gets away with stopping the technology transfers as part of the investment in China by Silicon Valley, and if he gets away with China indeed opening up its financial markets, as Wall Street has always wanted them to do, and this has been a major part of the trade negotiation, a major part of why the TPP didn't include China, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, that they were trying to force China to open up. You know, they'll be very happy with this, but meanwhile, they're holding their breath. As for the Koch brothers, you know, I think we see a very politicized fraction of the capitalist class, a highly politicized one, much more than the others, as you have written about so well. And their decision to turn against Trump on this stuff is very significant. Now, that said, the first signal of this was actually the Chambers of Commerce, in which they're very influential. And when you could see the Chamber of Commerce, which has been the most vociferous in terms of being worried about trade deficits, the association of the American capitalist class, which has been least enthusiastically behind the main strategy around trade in the making of global capitalism, when you've seen them articulating their opposition to what Trump is about on trade, you already had the sense at that point that the Koch brothers were very unhappy because they're very influential in the Chambers of Commerce. Now that they're doing it even more publicly is an indication that they themselves feel that is not enough, that Trump has enough autonomy from the capitalist classes, the major certain elements of them, that he'll bluster on. But on the other hand, there are structural constraints. There are real structural constraints on how far this can go. And those structural constraints have to do with the power of not only the Koch brothers, but of American multinationals everywhere and their interests. And there'll come a point when being compensated for by tax cuts and being compensated for by this vociferously a capitalist in the White House will no longer work for them. And you'll begin to see it in the degree of investments that they're engaging in and instability in the bond markets and instability in the stock markets. You know, those will impose real constraints. And the Federal Reserve, Powell at the Federal Reserve has said this. He, at a conference in Spain last month, began to point to those kinds of worrying signs, objective signs. And he's right to be articulating I think the Fed has most autonomy in relation to this Trump administration.
Yeah, it's very interesting that Trump has made war on so many institutions of American and international society, but he's left the Fed alone and appointed Powell, who is very much an insider and a smooth operator, not some kind of bomb thrower.
Yeah, and the left was so incensed, rightly, about the independent central banks movement that the right, the Friedmanites, the Hayekians, all were calling for, because that was clearly an attempt to ensure that democratic electoral pressures would not appear on the central bank agenda. Well, the irony now is that independent central banks means that the Fed can be slightly more autonomous than the Treasury from the White House.
Now, speaking of the Treasury, you mentioned in your article for the forthcoming Socialist Register with Sam Gindin that the Treasury may not have the institutional capacity anymore, and actually other agencies of the U.S. government, to manage a serious economic crisis. Let's talk about that some.
This is very significant, and it could apply to some extent to the Fed as well. I think that's what you need to look for. Sam's and my argument in the Making Global Capitalism was that to some extent it's the institutions of the American state, like the Treasury of the Fed and the Fed, that are more important in the superintending and management of global capitalism than are the military apparatuses or the security apparatuses. And what one needs to look for under this administration is, are they wasting away those institutional capacities? People have most commented on this in relation to the State Department, 1/3 of personnel not being replaced, the atrophy of so many of its diplomatic capacity. And looking at the Treasury, there are similar signs. In particular, there has been a reduction in staff of the controller of the currency, which is responsible for overseeing the middle-sized banks. Beyond that, there's been a large reduction in the staff in the Treasury, which serves the interagency bodies that attempt to engage in the regulation of finance, those that were specially set up under Dodd-Frank. And that's not just the Fed and the Treasury, but also the FDIC and a range of other agencies that are involved in financial regulation to the end of preventing shysters, but also to the end of trying to constrain the enormous chaotic volatility of finance. Those are very remarkable and important signs. Should there be another financial crisis, and it's by no means impossible, especially with the reduction in some of the regulations that have taken place, written by the Treasury, that legislation looks like it's coming from Congress, and it is officially. That never happens without the Treasury actually writing the amendments and the legislation back. And they've been involved in this. So, see volatility, which is the essence of this financial market, having effects in Argentina, in Turkey, in Indonesia, in Italy, it is bound to have some effects internally as well. Not least because, any disturbance in those markets has a disturbing effect on the international banks located on Wall Street. But there's also domestic reason why there's instability in volatility. Should there be a crisis, and should the Treasury not have the capacity to contain that crisis, this will be very, very serious. It's less evident that the Fed, although the Fed collaborated in allowing these deregulations from Dodd-Frank to take place, the Treasury took the lead, the Fed was more passive. Powell, before he became chair of the Fed, was complicit in it to some extent. But the lead was taken by the Treasury. So this is very important that the Fed, as you say, is still run by an insider who understands the Fed's role in this respect. The Treasury, not so clear, and one really needs to watch this.
Finally, we've only got about a minute or two left, but this war on these institutions that we've been talking about, or the neglect of them, seems like part of a war from the American right, at which Trump is now the sharp edge of, a war on instrumental rationality itself. I mean, capitalist rationality, it seems to be out the window. What's going on here?
Well, then we have to wonder whether capitalist rationality exists in the head of capitalists or not, and I've never thought so. I mean, there's a certain logic to capitalism, but too many people on the left, and to some extent even macroeconomic Keynesians, think that that logic is apparent to all of the actors, and that what actors do don't disturb that logic. Heaven knows they do. And under a Trump administration, people who make appeals to the logic of capital, you know, need to be very, very careful. You know, this is an incredibly contradictory and chaotic system. There isn't equilibrium that occurs behind the backs of capital. It very much needs managing. And because of the conflicts inside society that capitalism produces, we see that those conflicts, especially when there isn't a left that is very powerful in the United States, to put it mildly, then, you know, those conflicts take the form of all kinds of morbid symptoms. And we see, you know, working class people who voted Democrat since the 30s being frustrated to such an extent that they vote for these type of charlatans. And that can have a devastating effect in terms of the logic of capital, in terms of instrumental rationality.
That was the late Leo Panitch in an interview from August 2018. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. My first break music was mournful. This is anything but. Leo loved jazz, although I'm not sure how he would have felt about this instance of the genre, Stefan Grappelli's hot jazz version of the Internationale. But it seems a good note to go out on. The best way to memorialize Leo is to think hard, fight for socialism, and have some fun along the way. Till next week, bye.